97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
You know, Sue, sometimes I try to customize the bumper music for a guest if I know the person's musical taste. And this one was easy. Bernie Miklos is with us this afternoon. Bernie, it had to be Bruce, right? How are you? Welcome to the show.
First of all, great to be back with you. Just to talk with you again and, in effect, work together with you again. And I have to say, Mark, yeah, I was anticipating a little walk-in music.
Of course.
Of course. But well done and thank you.
Now, I always your name comes up every once in a while when I'm in the East Street world, and I always have to say, I've seen in the mid-40s, I've lost track of shows, but you're like well into the hundreds seeing the East Street Band, aren't you?
Yeah, I think maybe 125, 130. The thing I've slowed down, though.
Yes.
I mean, I haven't to shows. Yeah, I have not been to shows in a long time. And I'm not trying to avoid them. It's just, I don't know. It's weird. I love them. They're all events, and they're all unique into themselves, except it's maybe I just like to stay home. I don't know what it
is. Well, it's old age. I get it. You know, look, and I remember I was messaging you when I was in Barcelona last year because I was trying to let as many fans that I knew know that it was an amazing experience seeing the opening of the European tour. And that was something that was on my bucket list for a long time. But let's talk some sports here, Bernie Miklos. And you mentioned we're kind of working together because you're doing some stuff down the hall at my former station, KMOX, on a regular basis. And I thought this would be a good week to get you on talking about some baseball, et cetera. Let's start with what happened last night. You know, I spent almost 10 years in Milwaukee. I am married to a Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin native, and we were watching that game last night. I can certainly root for the Crew, Bernie, outside of the Cardinals, and that, boy, that was devastating. I didn't even text any of my friends up there because I know how painful that must have been for them.
That was the first postseason game I watched in its entirety, part of this first week. And listen, I never hesitate to say this. I really like the Milwaukee Brewers, and I'm not saying this as like a fan. I mean, I'm a fan of what they do, but it's like it's not like a disloyal thing, to St. Louis. They're just they're such a smart organization. They're so well run. They spend their money so wisely. They're always well managed, well coached. They have their minor leagues, the way they train and develop players, and they make them smart and they get them ready. I mean, they find bargains. The Cardinals will spend $15 million for a pitcher. The Brewers will get a better pitcher for, say, $7 million. I mean, they do that all the time. And despite having a much lower payroll over the years than the Cardinals, they continue to outperform the Cardinals. So I have immense respect for the Brewers. Yeah. I wish the Cardinals were that smart, and they're not. I wish they were. So I was bothered last night. I wanted them to win. And one of the reasons was Devin Williams, Hazelwood native, you know, really great guy, great closer. I felt so bad for him in particular. And it's, let me ask you this as a Brewers fan. You know, what is it? I learned with Tony La Russa, he'd have all those great teams and they didn't do well in the playoffs for a while. And playoffs are random. And you know, people don't want to hear it, but sometimes there's just no explaining it. But why do you think the Brewers have had such a hard time breaking through in the postseason?
I don't know, but it's painful for the fans. Look, when I moved there in 1997, and it was interesting, Bernie, because I moved in June of 1997. I could barely find baseball in the Journal Sentinel. They were already talking about the Packers. Now, that was the 4 months after Brett Favre won. But they have a lot of bad memories, of course, from 1982, so they don't like the Cardinals very much because that still sticks in their head. But you're right, though. They just can't seem to get over the hump, even when things are working their way. And you could feel the air just completely going out of what I still call Miller Park last night, and it devastating. And that, and then for Pete Alonso, a guy that most of us don't like, I mean, certainly a talented baseball player, but a big meathead, for him to be the guy that hit the home run, right?
Yeah, that's right. No, it's, listen, I love watching baseball there too. I've had some personal experiences in Milwaukee, like covering baseball primarily, where, I would go with a couple of the ball writers up there, and they would take me to these neighborhood places just for a couple beers and maybe some cheese curds. And
oh, yeah.
Maybe because I was a big guy, I'm just like a big guy. Oh, here comes the big guy. They treated me like I was a native Wisconsin. And I'm just like, oh, come on over here, big fella. Have a beer with us. And like, they didn't know who I was.
That's but it's how like they are up there, though. They're great.
They adopted me. Every time I walked into a joint, they would adopt me. One time at Lambeau Field, I get out of my car and I'm going to, getting into the stadium lot, and everyone's tailgating. I got stopped like five times. You know why? because I'm a big guy that looks like I could use a bratwurst, right? And they're like, big fella, hey, come on. Oh, you meaty? Yeah, I'm meaty. Where are you from? I'm from St. Louis. Oh, come on over here and have a brat with us, you know. I mean, what a great place.
Well,
that
they are like that. The Wisconsin people are definitely like that. It's a very, very friendly state. Are the St. Louis Cardinals fans being too harsh? I don't think they are, but let's ask the question this way. The Cardinals did have a much better season than the last year, Bernie. What the hell is going on?
Well, they let things slide, and, you know, they got away from their strength, which is player development, having a great farm system, being really, really smart in terms of teaching and instructing players. They cut back, you know, fun-wise. They cut back staff-wise. And it just got away from them, and I'm really surprised that it happened, because that was Bill DeWitt's thing. That's why he brought in Jeff Luhnow many moons ago, and it was very, very, very successful. And they sort of let that thing get away from them. And listen, I appreciate the fact that the Cardinals are now getting back to restoring their strength, their long-term strength. But they've caused a lot of damage to fan relations, and they know that. And I don't think Cardinals fans are spoiled. I don't think they're being unreasonable. Because there was no reason for this thing to fall apart the way that it did. And the Cardinals fans have been, you know, coming out 3 million plus strong at home for, you know, how decades, except for the COVID season. So that is the pact. That's the agreement, really, like the DeWitts have had with the fans. It's like, you support the team. You guys are great. We're going to do everything we can to keep winning. And in this case, the Cardinals kind of broke the covenant, you know, and I don't think because they're bad people. I just think they get – maybe complacency is the word. Maybe they let things get outdated. And I don't blame fans for being upset about it, because there's no excuse for the Cardinals to kind of fall into the hole they did last year. And I do think that this year they were fine, but it still wasn't good enough.
You know, the one couple of words that have been used here since Monday quite a bit is tone deaf. And, you know, I don't know what you say, because Bill DeWitt is asked, you know, how do you improve the game day experience? And he talks about, you know, better promotions. I don't know. But you do have a fan base that's very frustrated. And obviously a lot of that animosity is pointed toward Mo. So Mo staying in this transition plan that's now in place, what do you make of that?
Well, listen, John Mozeliak one day will be a Red Jacket Hall of Fame guy. His more than his first half of his tenure were just excellent. But he was part of the reason why the thing fell apart, and why they sort of, you know, they've only won, you know, one out of their last 10 postseason games. They've won 4 postseason games since 2016. I mean, come on, that's a big come down from where they were. There is, you know, I call it Mo fatigue. And, you know, the Mo fatigue through the years has just been growing and growing and growing, and people are just kind of burned out. So as long as Mo is there, and look, Bill DeWitt knows this. I talked to Bill DeWitt about it. But they're going to stick by him for all that he's done, and also because he went to them with a retirement plan, so they're going to honor it. But as long as Mo's there, I think it's going to be hard for them to really present the message. It's like, see, we've made changes. See, we're going in a new direction. Now, I love the Chaim Bloom hire. I wanted him to take over right away. Yeah. But I will say this. The magnitude of the job he has, which is to rebuild that farm system and the player development system, this is a huge, huge project. I can understand the reasoning of wanting him to fix that first, because, again, that's going to be the foundation of the franchise going forward.
So why do you like Chaim Bloom as much as you do?
Because he was a huge, huge part of the Tampa Bay operation, which is a model for how you win with less. And it's going to get Bill DeWitt back to what he loves, which is player development, payroll efficiency. And payroll efficiency is not a dirty phrase. Payroll efficiency just means being smart and not wasting money. And the Cardinals have really dished out a lot of bad contracts, and it's really hurt them. So that payroll efficiency and the player development just happens to be something that Chaim Bloom, those are his specialties. And, you know, if you look at his prime years there, 2008 through 2019, I mean, only 4 teams in the majors made the playoffs more often. And the Tampa Bay Rays, with their average payroll, it ranked 27th over all those years, sometimes 28th, 29th, 30th. They made more World Series than the New York Yankees from 2008 through 2020.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And yet, I got to tell you, I get irritated, because I hear from fans like, well, no, they never won a World Series. Oh, come on. The biggest payroll they ever had in a season was $77 million. And they're winning more playoff games than these huge franchises that have all the money you could ever dream of, including the Yankees, including the Red Sox. And they've even outperformed the Cardinals over all that time. The Cardinals and the Rays have been in the same number of World Series since 2008.
Ooh, and that, Cardinals jumps out at you.
and you know what? And here's the number for you. Sorry, I get fired up. So the Cardinals and the Rays have been the same number of World Series since 2008. Over that time, the Cardinals spent $738 million more than the Rays.
Wow.
That's why I like Chaim Bloom.
Yeah, well, that's a good answer, by the way. Ethan had a question.
Hey, Bernie, this is Ethan. Hey, Ethan. Thanks for coming on. Appreciate it. So,
love it.
You know, we know that Paul Goldschmidt will not be returning, or likely won't be returning next year. We know that the front office has come out and said that payroll is going to go down. But there's also been some reports that they're going to be shopping guys like Sonny Gray, like Nolan Arenado, like Wilson Contreras. I think people are forgetting how much of a chunk of payroll, you know, Paul Goldschmidt's contract was right there, and how much that's right. going to be coming off the books. Do you expect the Cardinals to continue beyond just Goldie's contract coming off the books? Do you expect it to be more than just that when we are looking at a decrease in payroll?
Yeah, but Ethan, the only prediction I would make, because part of it has got to be whether, say, Sonny Gray, who's got a no-trade clause, whether he wants to be traded. And if he wants to be traded, you know, they'll try to make that happen, and I would think would get a good return. You could say the same thing about Arenado, although I think he'd be harder to move because he's under contract through 2027, and he's kind of an old 33. You know, the decline signs are there. But the one thing I will predict, if they're going to rebuild the next couple of years, and it is a rebuild. They don't want to call it that, but that's what it is.
Yeah, it is.
But it's not going to be a lengthy, painful one. It's going to be relatively brief. But if you're going to do that, you have to trade Ryan Helsley because it just makes no sense. I mean, he's got a year left before he can become a free agent. He would have tremendous value on the trade market because the team that acquires him will have him for a full season. For the Cardinals to keep him, and he will walk away 100% in free agency after next season. For them to keep Ryan Helsley for a team that might win 78 games, 80 games, whatever, it doesn't make a lot of sense because they can get a lot for him, I do believe.
Bernie Miklas is with us this afternoon. So on the young talent question, I mean, the athletic story last week by Katie Wu was really devastating, and I think it revealed a lot of, you know, question marks even from within the organization. But when you're talking about Victor Scott and Jordan Walker and these guys that we were very excited about, are we not so excited anymore, or is there still a lot of potential there that has not been properly developed?
And I think she did a great job of bringing all these issues to light, because I've talked about it, how they don't have enough coaches and instructors. They don't have the technology. They don't have the proper facilities. It's amazing how far behind the industry they were. And she brought it to life with some real, like, real quotes and real testimony. I think the Cardinals have not fully prepared their young hitters, especially for the big leagues. And they fall into some bad habits, and then the Cardinals don't seem to know how to fix them. They fired their hitting coach this morning. You know, I don't know if they've officially announced it yet, but they did. Katie broke that story.
That's Turner Ward. Now, is that a
Turner Ward?
Is that a sacrificial lamb move?
Well, it depends. First of all, I think they, and I don't have time to get into all of it. I'd be happy to, but the Cardinals had so many bad habits at the plate, were mental things, where, you know, taking. There's only one team in the majors that took more called strikes than the Cardinals. It makes no sense. I mean, pitchers are throwing the ball down the middle all the time, and they're standing there. I mean, that's just not smart.
No.
I mean, that's an intelligence issue. So I think a new set of eyes working with these young guys can really make a difference. But I tell you what, here's the flip side. You fired Turner Ward, and I do think he was a problem. He wasn't getting through to the players, or he wasn't emphasizing the right thing. But if a new set of eyes comes in and they try to make these players smarter and it doesn't happen and they're still bad, that tells me your players aren't good enough.
You know, I've read your accounts throughout on the newsletter throughout the year, and I don't think you've been overly critical of Ollie. Of course, a lot of people want to just go right at the manager, and maybe there's even people this week that are disappointed that move wasn't made. But what would you say about Ollie Marmol right now? I mean, obviously, this is not his fault.
Yeah, I get in trouble with fans. They hate me because I stick up for him in some ways. I don't sit here ever and say, oh, this guy is a great man. I never say that. But he gets blamed for everything, or even the things that I think he does very well, he gets no credit for, because people are just down on him. And you know why they're down on him? Because they're burned out on Mo. They don't like Mo. and he's viewed as Mo's guy. And it's like, oh, he fired Schilt because that's his boy and all this stuff. So they're never going to give him a fair shake. And I'm not – some Cardinals fans will, but there's a lot that won't. But Ali Marmol this year ran the bullpen about as well as anybody did in the major leagues. And it's the only reason they had an 83-win season, because they did an incredible job of protecting leads in the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th innings. I mean, an incredible job. That team could have been a disaster without his handling of the bullpen. And, yeah, he truly did make a difference. It was one of the top 5-6 bullpens in the majors. And yet when I've brought that up, people are like, oh, you're crazy. He has no idea what he's doing. Well, I got about 25 facts to tell you he actually did really, really well with that. So I think – I hate to say this, but I think Ali Marmol's kind of doomed here. I just don't think he'll ever get a fair shake. And I do think that he does some things well. There's some things I don't like. But some of the things he gets criticized for are some of the things we see other younger managers doing with success. And in other words, he is cast by some Cardinals fans as like doing these like crazy, silly things. And actually what he's doing is trying to take advantage of the talent he has by using platoons and juggling the lineup to get better matchups. I mean, that is hardly like radical, boy, no one's ever done anything this nuts before. I'm not sure why people think that that's so
well
abhorrent.
We have a passionate fan base, I guess I would say.
Yeah,
that.
I mean, great. It's a great fan base. It's a wonderful fan base. But sometimes I think, just like we in the media, I think we maybe obsess and criticize the wrong things. You know, and maybe there's sometimes it's just hard to be as fair as you should be because you're in a ticked off mood.
Let me move 4 hours across the state just briefly, because this is an incredible story. 106 loss season, and now the Royals are positioned to, you know, make more noise in the postseason. That's an incredible story, isn't it?
It is, and I tell you what, the Cardinals, the state of the Cardinals, something can be learned by what the Royals did, and I'll make it brief. The Royals, when their new baseball operations chief took over, you know, the first thing he did was, of course, you know, put in new front office people, but also he hired a manager who came to the Tampa Bay system, the same Heim Bloom system, where analytics are a big deal, and if they're applied smartly, they'll give your team a competitive advantage. And Matt Quatraro is a total Tampa Bay analytics guy, and his players love it. And also their bench coach comes from the Tampa Bay system. But what they did, he hired J.J. Piccolo, their new general manager. He hired 30 people in one offseason, 30 people for the front office. He beefed up the scouting. He beefed up the player instruction in the minors. He greatly expanded their technology. And he almost overnight turned them into a much smarter organization that was putting the emphasis on the right thing. And then what they did is they made selective, you know, targeting free agent purchases. They spent about $111 million last offseason. And none of these things were like lavish spending. None of these things were exorbitant. They gave Bobby Witt Jr., who's a superstar, he's their own guy, they gave him a huge contract, but they should have. So once they were smart enough to take advantage of all the things that they did to try to get smart, they got smart first, then they started spending money. See, the Cardinals' problem has been spending money, throwing away money, making mistakes, and now it's like, oh, now we got to get smart. They had it the other way around. You get smart first, you get smart, you get the player development thing rolling, then you spend the money.
I love it. Bernie, it's so great to have you as part of the family here at Odyssey, doing some stuff on Camo X, and thanks so much. You know I'm a fan and have been for a long time, so thanks for jumping
Likewise.
On here with me, and we'll see. How do you feel about Mizzou tomorrow? Got a gut check there?
Boy, I don't know. I think they're going to win a tight one, but I'm not. I'd be lying. I'm not real confident.
No, me neither.
I don't know what it is. I'm just not confident.
I'm not either. I just don't like the way the offenses look, but look, they've had the bye week, gives me a little bit more hope. Bernie, have a great weekend.
Mark, thanks for having me on. Anytime, buddy. It's
all
good
right.
to be with you again.
I appreciate that. I love him, and I miss him from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, but I look at all the, you know, he was doing the stuff with Scoops with Danny Mac and the
That's
newswriter,
right.
and I always love his analysis, so it's great to have him here on the family. He's doing some hits on Camo X on Mondays and Fridays, I think. Thank you, Bernie Miklas. We got Rick Wakeman from the band Yes, who's coming to St. Louis at the Sheldon, coming up next. A little musical interlude here on a Friday evening. That is the legendary keyboard work and organ work of Rick Wakeman, who is with the band Yes, of course, did a lot of solo stuff, worked with David Bowie and many other artists. His final one-man solo tour is coming to the Sheldon on October 20th. And Rick Wakeman has been nice enough across the pond to stay up late for us here on a Friday evening. Rick, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk in St. Louis.
I'm very well indeed, thanks. It's I'm wide awake. I've been at it all day.
By the way, the Sheldon is an amazing venue here in St. Louis. It is,
yeah, it is.
The acoustics are great. Have you played there before? Do you remember?
I have. It's a great. I love it. It's a great place.
What do you remember? Let me start with some St. Louis questions, because I feel I grew up in Chicago before I moved here, and certainly I think Yes was on my, as a young man, as a young kid, on my musical radar. But I felt like Yes was a bigger deal here in St. Louis because of the legendary radio station that still competes against me, which is KSHE 95. Do you have an appreciation for yeah. what radio did in the 70s and 80s for Yes and for Rick Wakeman?
Certainly, Yes and prog rock and myself, we would never, ever have succeeded in the way we did without radio then. It was just so amazing. I mean, I remember when I first came to America in 1971, I mean, British radio was appalling, to put it bluntly. And so to come to America and hear FM radio was just astonishing. And of course, there was, back in the early 70s, jocks had so much freedom with what they could play. So everywhere you went, you heard different music, because you heard the music the different jocks played that they liked, that they did. And there's no doubt about it that America was responsible for, shall we say, the advancement of, certainly of prog rock, in fact, of rock in general, because radio-wise, was just so far ahead of everybody.
Yeah, you know, I didn't start, my first rock radio gig was 1984, 1985, and everybody thought, I love your point about, you know, the disc jockeys playing their own music, because there was a period where they did that. By the time, unfortunately, I got into it, I think I may have had one song an hour that I could do, which, you know, wasn't too bad, but there was a lot more freedom in the 70s.
No, I'm just going to say, no, you're dead right. I mean, it did stop a bit when formatted radio came in, you know, and that was, I mean, that was, I understood why it happened, because you're pandering to the advertisers,
yeah,
and things, and which where the money comes from, you're pandering to the commercials. But it was a great shame that, because I think the majority of the English rock bands or British rock bands would never have succeeded, or I can tell you well, for sure, would never have succeeded in America without radio.
Yeah, that's amazing, and I think we have an appreciation for that. But your story is interesting, because you never really wanted to be in a rock band, right? You were classically trained on the piano, weren't you?
Yeah, I was trained to be a classical pianist. I got my degree and everything in classical music, and but I loved rock music, and I loved music. And one of the things I wanted to do was I couldn't understand why the two genres were so far apart. And I thought, surely there's got to be a way of joining these together. You know, because it's just music at the end of the day. And that's what really what I set out to do with, you know, making rock albums, but with a sort of a classical bent to them, and using orchestras and classical musicians. And I love doing that, and still enjoy doing that to this day.
Well, and, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I just saw for the first time, I'd never seen Jeff Lynne in ELO. And I love, you know, I love bands that have keys. I love bands that have horns, you know, which is amazing as well. And that, you know, I think maybe that went away for a little bit in the 90s, but certainly I feel it's back right now.
It did. And it is, there's no doubt about it. It is coming back. People are using other instruments and bands. It's becoming more interesting to a lot of extent, and it's healthy. That's really, really good. You know, I know Jeff very well, and ELO were always just in their own field. Not only were unique, but ahead of their own game, which was great.
Absolutely. Look, I love Wikipedia. Maybe some of the stuff isn't true, but I noticed a note about Rick Wakeman on your Wikipedia page. It says, in 1963, at 14, Wakeman joined the Atlantic Blues, a local blues group that secured a year's residency at the Mental Health Rehabilitation Club in Neasden. I don't see that on rock bios very often, that you played a mental rehab clinic for a year, Rick Wakeman.
Yeah, it was. Do you know what? It was interesting. I was, 14, and we played at... It was a club specifically for Down syndrome kids. And what was interesting back then, I mean, how people treat mental illness and disability now is a lot different back then.
Yeah.
Back then in the 60s, 50s and 60s, they locked people away. So these kids were brought out to come to this club, and we would play for them, and they were just wonderful. And I learned so much about the Down syndromes and the kids, and they were just absolutely lovely. And it's interesting that one of the things I want to do, it's funny you should mention that, is that the drummer of that band, Atlantic Blues, his name was Ken Holden. He died 3 days ago.
Oh.
He lived in South Africa, and he died, and he was cracky 80, something like that, 84, 85, something. And I thought, you know what I'd like to do in his memory? I want to put together a band. I'll call it the Atlantic Blues again, and I'll do one show in England to raise money for the Down syndrome charity.
I love that.
In his memory. And that is, I mean, obviously it's only a few days since he passed away, but that is something that I intend to do next year.
Well, that's amazing, and I'm glad I brought it up. Did you by any chance, so here's a random name here from St. Louis, speaking to someone who just passed away. Did you know Bob Heil from St. Louis area, who created the Heil Talk Box? He was a big pipe organ guy. That's why I thought maybe you might be familiar with him.
Yeah, I do know that. I know the name. I don't know whether I met him or not. I can't remember, certainly the name, yeah.
Well, he was kind of a legend because he really was a pioneer in audio. He went on the road with the Grateful Dead in the early 70s. He became the guy that was really responsible for greater amplification, you know, stadium amplification with big speakers, which wasn't around, as you remember, in the 60s, certainly.
No, absolutely not. I mean, I know him, but I never got to meet him, but he is a sort of a, as the old expression goes, a legend in his own lunchtime, you know.
Absolutely.
With what he achieved and what he did.
Well, tell me about you got a new album out. Tell me about the show, what people will see here. You're coming to the Sheldon on October 20th. It's going to be a magical night. What's the show going to be about?
It's a mixture of music that I've been involved with over the years. Obviously, some Yes stuff. There's some of my stuff. I do some Bowie stuff, which I was involved with, and also Cat Stevens. A few surprises. I throw in some other influences. There's some Beatles stuff, which I do in a very strange way, which is good fun. Intermixed with lots of completely silly stories, of which they all have a small element of truth to them.
Well, I love that. Now, you mentioned, I'm kind of glossing over a big part of your career, because before Yes, you were a studio musician. You played with some of the names you just mentioned, David Bowie, Cat Stevens. You played on some of these great songs like Space Oddity, et cetera, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was great. It was a great period of time. I did. And I've remained friends with a lot. I mean, obviously, I was friends with David up until when he passed away. You know, I'm great friends with the Sabbath boys, especially Ozzy, because I did Sabbath Bloody Sabbath, and I also... an album that I love that I played on, which was Ozzy Osbourne's Osmosis album, which I think is just a brilliant album. To me, that's prog metal. It's a great album. And Ozzy and I remain good friends. He sang on a track of mine called Buried Alive on an album called Return to the Center of the Earth. I played with Elton John. I did the organ for Elton John on Madman Across the Water. It was just a wonderful period of time. And I met some wonderful people, of which those that are still with us, I'm pleased to say, are still friends.
That's amazing. Rick Wakeman, thank you so much for doing this with me. He's coming back to St. Louis on October 20th. The Sheldon, as I mentioned, a great venue. We really appreciate it. Are you on tour right now, or are you kind of on a break?
No, I'm going to Italy for a few days tomorrow with my wife. Because it's her, she won't please me for saying it, it's her 50th birthday, and I wanted to take her somewhere special. So we're going to the Lake Como in the wonderful Italian part of Switzerland called Lugano. So we're going there for a few days and then coming back, and then spend a bit more time with our rescue dogs, because we keep rescue dogs, and then I come to America.
Well, that's great. By the way, I love the rescue dogs. Rick, I gotta tell you this story. I had a rescue dog that I loved so much. He was 5 years old this summer. He ate one of those squeakers from a squeaky toy. He got it wrapped around his intestine.
Yeah.
We had emergency surgery a few weeks ago, but luckily, he's okay. He's fine right now.
Oh, that's good. Well, we've got two from Bosnia, from Sarajevo. They were in the war zone, very badly treated, but they're just wonderfully lovely. One of them we saved. He literally had his leg hanging off, and he was wrapped in barbed wire. And but he's fantastic now. He's really lovely. And this one also might shock a few people. We've got a little Labrador, which we bought from China, where she was on the menu in a restaurant.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Well, yeah. Well, we heard a little bit about that kind of stuff in the States these days. Rick, thank you so much. We'll see you in a few weeks.
Bless you. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Love this band so much. They're from Nashville, and they're basically a three-piece band, but I think they have, like, an additional member when they perform live at the Pageant tonight. Brand new song called Strawberry Jam. I like the name of this record, Sue, that this is on. I always like interesting stories, right, with the names of records, and I was reading about them a little bit today because this is one of those bands, you know, they play club shows. They're not extremely well-known, but they're played on alternative radio. But they have an album name right now that's called I'm Not Afraid of Music Anymore. Most of the time when you have an album name, there's a track on the album called I'm Not Afraid of Music Anymore, right? But there is no such track on this album. But the reason that they named it that is there was a six-year-old little girl who was the daughter of their producer when they were making this record. And she came in to sing some like background on one of the songs. I don't even know which song it was. And right after they wrapped, you know, the recording, the kid said, I'm not afraid of music anymore, just kind of randomly
that's
out of the blue.
So
and that's why they named the record that. So great band. I'm very much looking forward to seeing the show tonight. I do have an extra ticket if someone would like one because my friend Greg Harris, if you're listening right now, had to do something with his wife. His wife won over me.
What?
Even though this, I know, that doesn't seem right.
That is a shock to us all.
That does not seem right. So, Sue, I remember when I was in Columbia, Missouri many, many years ago, I even referenced KMIZ, the station that I did movie reviews at. And there was a guy that worked there named Kevin Steinkross. And he did weather and he did reporting. I came to St. Louis in 2006 and I started going to movie screenings as part of, you know, being a critic here. And I saw this guy. I'm like, wait, you're the same guy that was in Columbia, Missouri. And we kind of reacquainted and I realized he was a big name over here at Fox 2. And Kevin was a guy that went to Hollywood. I basically got his sloppy seconds as a critic. Let me explain it this way. They do these things called junkets, right? So movie studios invite you to come out and meet the cast and interview. They, you know, they schmooze you. They put you up at the Beverly Hills Four Seasons. Typically, in a market the size of St. Louis, they wouldn't send two people. But Kevin was there 80% of the time. When he couldn't make it, I would go. And sometimes we were there at the same time. But it was kind of a budget thing for the studios. They're not, you know, if we're in Houston or Chicago or a bigger city, you get more outlets. But anyway, we got to know each other. I was a big fan of his. And then, as you remember, and some people might remember this story, he went on MLK. I don't even want to say the whole name because I'm getting in trouble. He went on MLK Day in the morning, and he said something that sounded like he said Martin Luther, and he sounded like he said coon, but he didn't. He was blending the words together. Somebody complained about that, and they went on the air later that morning, and he apologized. And the Post-Dispatch picked up on it, and it became a thing. And Kevin Steinkross has never, ever been seen on television since that day. Now, I'm relatively confident that he got a big check, and I hope it was a big check, but his whole Hollywood career was killed because you had people that were responsible for arranging those things that said, look, I can't put this guy in a position. What if somebody says, hey, you're the guy that said the N-word? So it completely ruined his career.
Yeah.
Ruined his career. So I bring that up because National Review editor Rich Lowry was on Megyn Kelly's show a few weeks ago. And in the middle of a discussion, he said something that sounded like something else. So I'm going to play you the entire context here. Okay, this is Megan and Rich having this conversation a couple of weeks ago.
Finally, he said something to the effect of, look, if we have to create stories in order to bring attention to what's happening, the media, he admits they made it up, right? As opposed to, and if you listen to the full clip, he says, by drawing attention to what's happening on the ground, it's just, as the
like
line goes online,
with,
you don't hate the media enough. Go ahead.
You remember Alternative Facts with Kellyanne? They did the same thing. She wasn't saying you make up fictions and pretend they're facts. You bring other facts to bear in the debate that are being ignored. And that's what he was saying. And I loved, I think it was in that interview where Dana Bash says, you know, the police have gone through 11 months of recordings of calls, and they've only found two Springfield residents calling to complain about Haitian migrants taking.
Okay, that was it. You heard that? It sounded like he said the N-word. We've isolated here.
To complain about Haitian migrants.
Okay, so then you have people on Twitter, Media Matters does it, you have people on Twitter saying, oh, Rich Lowry, forgetting he isn't just chatting with his buddies and saying the quiet part out loud, 42 seconds in, he says, Haitian N-word. I'm no Lowry fan, not even close, but he didn't say, oh, some people came to his defense. I'm no Lowry fan, not even close, but he didn't say the N-word here. He got tongue-tied for a split second. And that's exactly what happened. Okay, he just stumbled over the words migrants and immigrants, and it came out that way. This is very, very similar. In fact, When this happened with Kevin, this has happened in other markets. There was a New York anchor that basically did the same thing. And there were linguists that were interviewed when anyone paid attention to the story that said, look, it's a very natural thing. Martin Luther King Jr. So think about the blending of that and what it might say in this particular situation. Migrants and immigrants. So he says something that sounds different. So NPR does a story about this. And, you know, they basically say, oh, you know, look what Rich Lowry said here. The NPR story was then updated several hours after it was published. The story's original headline read, conservative editor-in-chief appears to use racial slur to refer to Haitian migrants. Now, look, that is journalistic malpractice. There appears what? He misspoke, and you want to all of a sudden make this a racial thing, right? The headline was later updated to conservative editor-in-chief says mispronunciation led to accusations using slur, which, by the way, that's a more accurate headline. Yeah. NPR's standards editor, Tony Calvin, or Caven, explained why the headline and story were modified. The focus of the story was changed, frankly, to, I think, better reflect what actually happened. Oh, my God. They actually took time to get it right. Which was that he said something, and some people will make it seem like he said the slur. He said he had not, and I think I would argue the original framing of the story was not fair to him as it should have been. There is no correction on NPR's website noting those changes. Caven said that that's because there was nothing factually wrong with the first story. He just said that the headline needed more editing. But what's interesting here is that the public editor actually disagreed with the standards editor, and they said, we disagree with NPR on two points. First, the story as originally published wasn't just unfair. It was inaccurate. The story told readers that Lowry appeared to use the racial slur. That's not true. Second, after recognizing that the story was wrong, NPR should have acknowledged the changes to both the headline and the body of the story, because readers were much more likely to come away from the original story with the belief that Lowry actually said the racial slur. A clarification note would be public acknowledgement that the first story fell short. So I guess the bottom line here is that they may have done somewhat of the right thing. NPR's public editor at least had the decency to criticize her own outlet for getting it wrong and, you know, calling them out. This is very rare from my perspective.
It is, yeah.
And it's actually shocking that it happened. But let's face it, what happens in these situations? The first version of the story gets out and everyone thinks that's what happened, right? So,
yeah.
But I had not heard about this until today, so maybe a lot of people didn't hear about it.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right, I'm going to keep it short, and it's our current president. Remember him, Joe Biden? This is kind of funny. He went to the briefing room today, and they asked him a question about whether or not he's back in the race.
Do you want to reconsider dropping out of the race?
I'm back in.
It was actually a pretty good moment.
That's funny.
He was walking out the door with KJP, and they said that, and he stopped, and he looked around, and he goes, I'm back in. And, you know, maybe we need more moments like that from this president moving forward. It was actually a lighthearted moment for a Friday. I'm off to see Coin at the pageant. Sue, you have a great weekend.
Thank you.
We'll be here Monday starting at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.